History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories right there around you that really need to be told, that we're all better off for the privilege of hearing. The goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. With the 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion approaching, we've been counting down to D-Day, and we'll continue that today with two men who experienced that longest day in very different fashions. Since this is Memorial Day weekend, we'll also take a turn in that direction before we're done, hearing from a man whose new book honors his uncle who never made it home from World War II. You can find links to all the material mentioned today at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll begin that Normandy focus with the memories of Oklahoma native E.T. Roberts, who landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day with the 115th Regiment of the 29th Infantry Division.
We were to hit Omaha 8/20 D-Day with assisted assault, we were told. And they said there'd be bomb craters on the beach when we trained. And I trained with rifle and flamethrower, too. I had a flamethrower when I hit the beach. And I went off the ramp, and I never did touch bottom. And I turned the flamethrower loose. And I had a soldier behind me that had my full field pack. I had a lot of good stuff in my pack, in my bedding, my eats, and everything in that pack. And he had my rifle. He's supposed to go off the same time as me behind me, and as soon as I got rid of that flamethrower, give me my rifle and stuff and let me go. But I've never seen that boy yet today. I don't know whatever happened to all that crew, but I had to turn that flamethrower loose. It's going to drown me. And the tide was so high, it come up under my helmet like it broke my neck, and I had to lay there on the beach until I got my neck straightened up. I crawled over and got a rifle from a soldier that was wounded there, or dead. I'm sure he's dead because I see his entrails and stuff laying out on the ground that were shrapnel. What I disintegrated him almost. Anyway, I got up on the beach and went up on the hill, and all I ever saw of my whole company was seven of us left. I don't know whatever happened to the rest. I've never seen them yet today. And then when we went into combat, I got wounded about 29 days after I got into combat at St. Lo, and I went out, and when I came back into combat, they didn't send me back to my company. They sent me back to 116th.
As you're heading toward Omaha Beach, and you're on that landing craft, I imagine the big picture of everything you could see in every direction was something that you've never seen again since. What did it look like as you were approaching that beach?
When I was sitting out there, we were hit June 5th. We were supposed to hit the 5th, and the tide was so high that we couldn't go in. We had to sit out there, and you could step from ship to ship that was taking soldiers in there, and you couldn't see nothing across that ocean as far as you could see, with ships and stuff going in to make the invasion in there. And we went in the next June 6th, the next day. All of us was seasick, but when you say ramp down, you got to get off. You can't turn back. You got to go. So we had to go. And when you hear people today say, "I'm sick, I can't go to work," think about something like that and see how that fixed. Well, they dumped you off over there seasick, and the boat was full of vomit and stuff that way. It really was. It was a mess. So that's what we went through with. And then it was 9 days before we ever got any good clothes to put on. We hit that salt water and stuff. You can imagine what our feet and stuff was.
And I want to ask you, as you hit that water, you described for us having that flamethrower on, and this is a big heavy thing that you're going to wear on your back, 72 pounds of equipment there.
and you come off that ramp, you're expecting your feet are going to hit bottom, but you just kept sinking?
Well, they told us and said, unbuckle your chin straps because the tide will come up under your helmet. And I didn't unbuckle my chin strap. The flamethrower I thought would help me too. But the flamethrower is what took me down so fast that tide came up under and hurt my neck, like broke my neck, I guess. And since I came home in civilian life, I'd had two discs replaced in my neck and everything.
It's not exaggerating to say that you nearly died just coming off the landing craft.
Oh, sure. I'm lucky to be here today. People could never, I can't even understand myself how I ever lived through the smoke and gunfire. He said you couldn't hear nothing. It was the smoke, it was strangly, it was so thick, gun smoke. Just shell after shell and big facing a cannon sitting inside of a wall that was far and out there and nothing. I saw little LCVPs come in there, not one soldier get off of it. That shell, the way they had it, big, the gun emplacement, they said had 4 foot of cement in it and sitting in the walls, just like going into a side of a house and look out the windows. The gun placements looked like that to me. I could see them far and all out of there. I told the guy on the Marine or sailor, whatever he was on the ship, I said, open fire on him. Open fire on that guy there. He was the security right off the top. Not on where he ever went to. That's when we was going in. I could see that firing was taking place there. But when I got out on the beach and I got straightened up and got up off of the beach, I met about seven people from the same company I didn't know, even hardly. Got me a rifle and stuff and went on through there, and I got wounded with St. Louis. I got changed from first scout to a squad leader, and we were completely replaced 9 times. So when they start to ask me, tell me names and stuff, I finally got to push, I'm just going to call you soldier. And that's about the way I think today. People tell me names, and I can't think of names. I think of stuff like that so many names came and said, well, this is so-and-so, this so-and-so, and maybe 30 minutes he'd be not there. I've seen him last about 30 minutes in combat, and that's about it.
Certainly there on June 6th, and it's been called the longest day for a really good reason, especially the part of it you were in.
I couldn't get off of there. I was sick and had to lay there, and I got my neck straightened up, and the water was solid blood. I mean, it was just like a bloodbath going through it there. The beach, you couldn't walk without stepping on a dead soldier. You crawled and made your way around through there to get off of the beach, and finally I did. Got off the beach. I don't know. Some people say, how long did it take you to get off the beach? I don't know. And I don't think anybody else would. There's so much going on and everything that you couldn't even tell anybody your name, probably.
So it's definitely loud. I'm sure the smell was horrific. Obviously, what you're seeing is something that no one has ever seen or experienced before. And I'm just trying to imagine myself in your shoes. How did you keep going? Weren't you scared to death?
You're past scared. You don't even know who you're at or what you're doing. Think about fighting day and night. 27 days without ever coming off of the front line, and the only way it got you off is to get shot. And then I was out 26 days back into combat. Went back to England and patched me up and sent me back into combat.
Another thing you mentioned about D-Day, you talked about finding seven other guys from your company. For people who aren't familiar with how that works, how many people were in your company to begin with? How many from your company were supposed to hit that beach?
200-something soldiers there in the company. I never did see any of the boys, the lieutenant or nobody. I'd never seen no one after that. So I don't know where the bunch of them went. One good friend that I did meet him, and he went in with me there. And last time I saw him, he had his heel shot off. We hit the ground, machine gun fire came up. He didn't put down his feet flat like you're supposed to turn your feet out flat. He stuck his heels up, he put his toes to the ground, and he shot his heels off. And I went over and talked to him a little bit, and I said, well, I got to go. We was moving at that time, and I had to go on, and we was trying to run them people out of there. And that's, I don't know whatever happened to that boy. It's just one of them things that happens in combat. I had another friend came in there that I knew, got acquainted with from Oklahoma boy, Donald Crawford. The artillery shell was coming over, and I told him, I said, get your whole artillery. You can hear artillery coming over. And I said, go get your hole. And I don't know why he did, but he put a piece of tin over his hole. When he started to go down the hole, piece of tin caught him on right above his forehead, just scalped him almost. I don't know whatever happened to that boy either. Things like that happens in combat.
Yeah, and we know what happened to you, and we're going to find out the rest of what happened to you. I wonder, you talk about climbing into your hole, and as that longest day came to a close, and you tried to find out if you could actually sleep that night and think about what the future might hold, were you able to sleep? How could you possibly sleep after a day like that?
We don't know when we slept. I mean, I've asked some guys, they know when they slept, but not a combat boy that was in there and hit that beastie day. If they tell me when they slept, I would sure like to talk to them and understand how they would sleep, because I never remember sleeping. I think I sleep with my eyes open. I believe that's the only way we did sleep. And another thing, when you get replacements in that way, and you talk about sleeping, you don't know. The guys you train with, you could trust. I mean, he'd say, well, you go ahead and go to sleep, and I'll pull guard duty while you sleep. But at nighttime, when you set up to get some rest, and you say, okay, you sleep a while, and I'll sleep a while. You go to sleep, you wake up, and he's asleep too. He might have been a butcher or a candlestick maker or whatever. You don't know what they are when they come into combat replacements. They're not trained like we were trained to fight, and it's very scary to be in combat with people like that.
And obviously you had a close call just getting off the Higgins boat, hitting the beach. But for the rest of that day on Omaha Beach, the bloodiest day of that invasion, the bloodiest spot of that invasion, how close did gunfire, artillery, or any of that come to you personally?
I could hear it whistle above my ears. I've heard shells sing beautiful song right beside my ears, bullets and stuff. And just, look, when I got wounded, there was two. One went off my helmet, one hit me in the shoulder, and three went through my field jacket. So, and the flame hit me right in the face. I faced the face with one. And what happened, the kid that was one of the replacements was there. He was hollering at me, said, the soldier said, get this guy off my back. They'd done come over the hedgerow and got on his back, and I turned to get his back, and this one came over the hedgerow with a burp gun and came right down at me, and all I ever saw was flame and fire. And I didn't know I was shot for a while, and I kept trying to get my gun up, my arm with shoulders cramping and everything. And blood was running all over me, and I was trying to get my gun up to shoot another what was coming over there, and then I knew that I was finished. So when I started out, I laid down my rifle and walked off, and I got back to the hedgerow behind me, and right at the, I started to go out the gate, there's a German pull down on me again. I thought, well, this is it here. And he saw I was bloody and sick and everything, and he let me go. So I went back, and that's when I had to go to England and patch me up.
So here you are, you've been on the front lines basically for a month, and you're in St. Lo, and you talk about this burp gun, and people who maybe haven't seen one before, I mean, this is an automatic rifle, Schmeisser, that the Germans had that could fire rounds so fast.
They call them great little grease guns. There's like our little Thompson subs, they call them. And that's exactly what they are, although they're a little smaller. And they will spit some rounds out at you, yes.
So fast that they could literally saw you in half.
Oh, yes, yes. He thought he had it to center me, but he had it to side of me, luckily. And I was trying to punch another guy off of one's back there, and I'm sure that I got him off of there. But I don't know about this. The guy was shooting me of what I done to him. Or
how far away was he from you?
He was in slapping distance.
So from point-blank range, he's firing this gun that can pump out multiple rounds a second, and five of them hit you?
The fire was just blinded me. I mean, it was so close to me that he's right in my face, and, I didn't have... In fact, he's further than my gun would reach, even closer to me. And he just cut me to right down me. I got to him with the gun. I could have punched him with my gun or something. But
it sounds like you were in a bit of shock.
Well, I guess I was, because there was so much going on. I was trying to help somebody, and then it all jumps on to me. When it starts coming over the hedger on top of you, too, then you got to start doing something for yourself. And you're kind of off guard a little bit. That's the reason, I guess the only reason I got out of that I always wanted to help other people or do things.
Well, it kind of sounds like someone somewhere must have been helping you, too.
I think God had a great hand in it helping me, because I never was afraid. I always thought that I would be taken care of, and that's what I feel today, that God has a big hand. And he's not finished with what he wants me to do. And that's something I want to do. It's whatever he asked me to do today, I want to do it.
Amen. It sounds, I didn't live it, you did, and I'm trying to imagine it, but it sure sounds pretty miraculous that you survived that, a burp gun from that close range.
Well, if it had been in the center of me, I wouldn't have, but the way it was, in my shoulder, in my arm, and off my helmet and everything, through my field jacket, it didn't get no part of me, and in no other part but just that part, which that's the reason I had to go out and then come back in combat. They have to go through that to swab it out and clean it, because when you get shot through your shoulders or wherever you get shot, it takes material, whatever it is you got on, that it takes it in there, and they have to go in there and clean that out.
Or you can get infected pretty easy.
You get infected. That's what they have to watch for a few days, gunfire. It gets infected very fast.
And there was another thing that you said when telling that story, that call it the hand of God or whatever, but you said another German saw you, had a shot at you, and didn't take it.
Standing one hedgerow back behind us, already ready that far back. I didn't know that it got behind us that far. And when I started through the gate, they just got openings to every hedgerow, like where a wagon or whatever can go through there. And when he pulled down on me, I thought, well, that's it. I was walking pretty close there. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he let me go.
Otherwise, we never would have heard that story from D-Day survivor E.T. Roberts. If you like, you can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, imagine flying an unarmed, powerless airplane into Normandy, landing it behind enemy lines, and getting out alive. For the man we'll hear from next, that was his reality on June 6, 1944. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing our countdown to D-Day's 75th anniversary on this Memorial Day weekend 2019. More on Memorial Day in a bit, and next time we'll focus on paratroopers who jumped behind enemy lines. But how much do you know about the more than 800 gliders that made a daring descent behind enemy lines on June 6, 1944? If you'd really like to dive into that history, I highly recommend a trip to Lubbock, Texas, and the Silent Wings Museum, one of the best museums I've ever been to, complete with an actual glider from World War II, and even a replication of Rommel's asparagus, the strategically placed poles meant to deny safer, effective landings for glider infantry groups. Morris Bennett was one of thousands of would-be glider pilots to train there in West Texas.
Lubbock, Texas was going to be the main training base for combat gliders. We got to Lubbock, and they said, well, we got too many here to train at the same time, so everybody's going to have to go through engineering school at Wichita Falls, Texas. And that is how to put the gliders together, how to manufacture them, repair them.
And for people that aren't familiar with it, what are these gliders made out of?
They're made out of tubing, and plywood and plexiglass, and covered with fabric, which was dope that they used to use in making model airplanes. So they were just the same idea, what they call dope on the fabric, and that would make it reinforce them. So we went, we had to graduate from there, and then you went back, then we went back to Lubbock, and we took our advanced training there. And that was the fall of 43, and I graduated from Lubbock in December of 43.
So we're still a little more than 6 months away from D-Day here, and you would spend some of that time undergoing ground warfare training like an infantryman or artilleryman would. They had you ferrying gliders from base to base around the country, and then one day they tell you, you've got to go to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for some special training. I'm sure you had no idea how significant this was going to become. Tell me what you remember about that.
We went on down to Fort Bragg, and we were there about 10 days, took special training. We weren't told what our mission was going to be, but we knew we were going to go to Europe. And we got to Fort Wayne, Indiana. We was given all our shots, and I issued special ammunition, special guns, special revolvers, and special watches. And we sat there for about a week. In the meantime, what had happened, in Europe, the weather had changed, so they had to change the invasion date for Normandy. I know we were slated to be dropped way behind the lines, this fellows that was doing this type of work for reconnaissance or take some special deal. They never did tell us what it was, but with the equipment we had and the shots we had, we knew we was going to be on something special. But anyway, they called that mission off, sent us to Boston, and we went, instead of flying us over where we were supposed to go, in other words, we went across on a troop ship, which was took 3 or 4 days, and I joined the 439th Group in the 94th Squadron of troop carrier, which had been in England about 6 or 7 weeks, something like that. We knew that invasion was coming very shortly, so we had to carry full packs and run for every day. And so we got there, and they didn't have enough American gliders, so I had to fly an English glider, a horse glider, and the Normandy, and I went on June 6th, in other words, just a breaking day, probably. We was on double daylight saving. It was probably 4 o'clock in the morning. We took off from our base, and I had just had paratroopers is what we had instead of glider fighters, which normally glider infantry is what we normally would carry. But they had put paratroopers in these gliders, and they didn't like, they'd rather jump than ride a glider. The horse, a British glider, will hold 30 people, plus the pilot and the co-pilot. And we had gas masks, so we didn't know what we would have. So we were one of the few gliders that landed intact in Normandy. And we landed, like I say, it was just breaking day. The pro ships had already been in and flown paratroopers in and dropped them about 4 hours before we went. And they came back to England, refueled, tied up on the gliders, and when they would take us off, we were, Cliff Mueller, which passed away a few years ago, he was and I flew together, and we were in the air. Cliff was on in the first pilot seat, and I was on the other one, and we couldn't get the nose wheel up. The pilot, the tow ship was already in the air. Normally, the tow ship is still on the ground, and we were in the air, but you could see the exhaust, because this was dark, you could see the blue coming out of the exhaust, and we were still on the ground. We were about ready to cut off and land in the ocean, and we went ahead and made the deal. We were back about, I think we was 45 or 40, usually 50 gliders in a stick, what we call a group. Each group would have a deal, and takes about 45 minutes to make the group together to come back in a formation. And they're 4 abreast, just staggered 4 across.
Well, and it seems to me, and again, a lot of people might have no knowledge of gliders at all, so they probably want to know, what were the tow ships? How did you guys get airborne? What?
Normally on a horse glider, they were towed by the British 4-engine Fairfax bombers. But our C-47s or DC-3s, which are, some people call them one thing, some people call them something else, they were able to tow a horse, a glider, or 2 CG-4 gliders on twin tow, which we flew later on, but not on Normandy, which was just a single tow on, or even on the CG-4s. Like on takeoff, when we couldn't there, here about 10 years ago, Cliff came by and visited me one day, and he says, I guess you know you saved my life. And I said, why is that? He says, don't you recall telling those paratroopers to some of them get back in the plane a little bit so we get the nose wheel off? And I said, no, I don't remember. And he says, well, I sure as hell did.
You had to rebalance the plane, huh?
Yeah, I had to balance it up to get, that's how come we was able to go ahead and get off. Otherwise, we would...
You never would have gotten off the ground.
In other words, we would end in the ocean. And with these 30 guys behind us, that's much aid in this thing. And we weren't that really good horse or pilots because we hadn't flown that, in a horse or that much. The CG-4, in other words, I could have done a lot more with it, but they were not with that thing.
You spent over a year training to fly one kind of glider. Then on the biggest day of your life, you end up in a glider you've never flown before. And you're going to end up in the English Channel, and you're all going to sink in the ocean if you didn't make that adjustment, huh? Where do you think that came from? What clicked in your mind to ask them to do that?
I don't know. It just wasn't coming off. We said we got to get some weight in the back end up to get the nose up. I don't know. It's just one of them things that you do.
What was your mission, and how did it unfold?
Normandy, in other words, we landed, like I say, about daylight. We got to the CP. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, which was a command post where the 101st troopers, paratroopers, and with St. Mary Galice is where the town was that we landed, and that's where the CP was in an apple orchard. We got there, in other words, I told the glider pilots, in other words, you head back for the beach. Your mission is done for this deal. Go back to the beach and you fly another mission. So we started back, walking back. Some people rode a bicycle or mostly walking. There was about 15 of us got a Jeep that had been wrecked earlier. We got on it and got back to the beachhead, and the tanks were coming in. By this time, it was probably 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. One of the tank commanders says, get that pile of junk out of the road, and we just drove off the side of the road and off the sand dune and walked on the rest of the way in. And then they said, well, these guys have all lost their guns and everything coming in, so stack your guns and ammunition over there, and these other fellas have lost theirs on the landing. They've got something to work with. And they said, get on this landing craft and go out to this British cruiser that has shot its guns out on the earlier landing. They were earlier that morning. They're going back to Britain. So by 9 o'clock, I was on this cruiser, and the next morning I was back in England. And I got a 3-day pass because, in other words, everything worked all right, and I didn't have to go back on another mission on that one.
But I'm sure there's a lot more to that day than what you just shared with us. You take off from England, and you are going over the English Channel, being towed by these bigger planes. What did you see? Did you see a bunch of other gliders? Did you see bombers everywhere? Did you see ships down below? Paint a picture for us.
Thousands of all types of battleships. The Navy there was the landing. In other words, we could see the firing. In other words, ahead of us where we were headed. And as the tow ships went in earlier, as I was said, earlier, in other words, they dropped the paratroopers, and then so when the tow pilots got close to where the anti-aircraft fire was coming up to us, in other words, they already had turned, and they'd be going straight ahead on us, but they'd already turned, and it was off to our left. It was almost 0.25 degrees from where they should have been, and so we kept going as far as we could till we cut loose, and we seen a field that we could land in that didn't have the telephone poles, what they call the Rommel's asparagus, and the hedgerows is what got most of us. We had no idea that they briefed us on the hedgerows, but they didn't tell us that the hedgerows are full of rocks, which was maybe 10, 15, 20 foot wide and 10 or 15 foot high. And that's what most of the gliders ran into. In other words, that landed, the crash stop was hitting the trees and the hedgerows.
So I'm going to ask you some dumb questions here, just because this is not something most of us are familiar with. When you say you cut loose, how do you do that? How do you get the glider loose from the tow?
You just hit a lever, and it drops the ring out of the tow ship, out of the glider, and that's it. And the tow ship can cut you loose, too, because they could do the same thing. They could do the same thing. They're supposed to have somebody watching the glider all the time, but sometimes they didn't do it.
So on this one, June 6th, you pull that lever. You're on your own. You've got 30 paratroopers in your plane with you and a co-pilot. You're responsible for all these lives. You're on the most intense day of battle in world history, basically, is what you're facing here. You get a little adrenaline rush there. What was going through your mind as you cut loose and realized, here we go?
You don't realize that the people behind you there, in other words, you just go ahead and do what you were trained to do, and you do it automatically. You find a place that you could get in and land and try to get down in one piece is what's the biggest thing that you try to do on that type of thing.
And could you see the artillery and the ships below firing away at everything, or no?
Oh, yes. You can see the fighting on the ground. But we're only at 500 feet, so you're not going to see very much. We come in land at a close, about 500 foot is where we come in land. And it wasn't like the Risley flew up high and cut loose and circled and come down. In other words, they pulled you in right close to where you're going to drop off.
Well, that seems to me like it would make it worse, because there's even less margin for error when you come in at 500 feet. So what did you see, and how did you know where to go and where to land? And were you scared at all? Because I'd be scared out of my mind.
Well, in other words, we were briefed about these fields being flooded with water. Of course, you knew it wouldn't be very deep. I could see a cut in the trees where there was an open deal and a little field beyond that. And if you were good at what you were doing, you was able to get into it. And we figured we'd get into it, and we did. All we did was knock the nose wheel off when we hit one little ditch across, because you couldn't tell from the air by a little ditch. But we knocked the nose wheel off, and otherwise it was landed right up where we're supposed to be. And everybody got off. There were a few of them sick. But
okay, so now you're coming in. You fly in over the beaches where all this fierce fighting is happening, and you're supposed to land behind enemy lines. You don't really have a way out of there other than your 2 feet. How do you know where you're going, and how do you think you're actually going to make it out of this alive? You know there's a war going on.
It depended on the guys that you had with us. There was the troopers, because they were more advanced than we just followed the boards. We were just a trooper then. After we got on the ground, we were just whatever the, maybe he was a first sergeant or somebody else. He says, in other words, like the band of brothers, you come on with me and you go, we'll get back to where we're supposed to go. We knew we was going to be the same, at least we knew about where we were, but not exactly.
Did you have any idea? I mean, obviously your own life is in jeopardy here, but did you have any idea of what those paratroopers would be up against with the kind of fighting they were going to face?
No, I don't think any of us really knew what was going to be the up against. It was one of those things that everything worked out good for me.
Was that landing? Were you anxious? Were you nervous?
No, I wasn't. Just like no different than flying in Indianapolis when I would come in and land in where I was supposed to be, or the first time when I ran out of gas. I had another one when I was in training. In other words, on ferry. In other words, the tow ship, the glider came loose from the tow ship. They didn't make a good connection with the tow ship. And I was over out of St. Louis in the Ozarks. Everybody and all the farmers in little towns in the woods in the Ozarks, they come looking. Here was an 85-foot airplane in our backyard. And it had been snowing, so there was probably about 3 or 4 foot of snow on the ground. But I flew a pattern in, I seen a little hump in the snow, and I figured that was a fence, and sure enough it was. So I just got over it and sat down, and I dug in the snow, and I flew up to this guy's barn, landed right close to his barn. They took us in the house and fed us biscuits and bacon, and boy, really had a real good meal. And pretty soon the constable came, which is the law enforcement they had on the new Model A car, and he took us to the little bus stop. And I had a telephone there, and I called the base, and they said, oh, we already know that your tow ship circled you and said you were down okay. So, but the tow rope had come loose from the glider. We never did anything, so we just left it there, and the Army sent in a ground crew and picked it up.
Well, in the snow by St. Louis, they're waiting for you with bacon and biscuits. But on June 6th, when you put that thing down, was there concern that enemy forces might be nearby?
Oh, yes. We knew they were ground people because we'd seen them. The dead fellas already there where the paratroopers had already been fighting with them on our way to the CP. And we knew that they were being shot at every once in a while then. So we took the hedgerows, the roads along the hedgerows, and we'd be in the ditches. We stayed in the ditches like that until when we were strung out maybe 10 or 15 feet apart protecting each other. Till we got to the CP. And then on the way back, when we was in that Jeep, whether we got come under sniper fire for a while, but we took care of the 17 that was took care of him, and then we went on our way back to the beachhead.
And did you have any special instructions for what you were to do with the glider after you landed it?
Just leave it.
I know, I'm sure you've told these stories before, but you describe it so matter-of-factly, and it sure seems intimidating to me to land a glider behind enemy lines and have to work your way back, not knowing where the enemy is, to be shot at by snipers, all of this stuff that you've never experienced before, and you're just a young kid. What do you think it was that helped you get through that and helped you believe you could?
I don't know. It's just the way that, I suppose, the way that I was raised, in other words, and worked on. My dad was killed when I was 1930, so I was 8 years old in an automobile accident, a foggy morning at Hanford. And so I lived with my grandfather and my uncles, and they did taught me all the things that I needed to know to survive.
They must have taught you pretty well. So you told us how you got back, but even when you get back to that beach and you're supposed to go out to this British ship, what did that beach look like? I mean, was there devastation everywhere?
Well, we were strafed a couple of times. We had to dig into the sand because of the Germans they came and strafed the beach with fighter planes a couple of times, but didn't last very long until our fighters took over, and that was it. They were still firing at that first on the 6th of June at night. That night, they were still fighting on the beachhead.
And you got to get off that beach. A landing craft took you to that British ship. But I imagine there are a lot of images from that 24-hour period you simply cannot erase from your memory. What'd you see from the deck of that ship?
I seen this big ship ahead of mine or something. And it was big. It was maybe 200 or 300, 400 foot long. I mean, a big ship. I don't know whether it was a cruiser or what. But it just went up in the air, and then down I went. And you knew all these guys were on it. Never seen anybody get off of it. So, I mean, that was probably the worst thing that I'd seen as far as of all the other things that happened. And that was just before dark.
So many American lives in harm's way in so many different ways on June 6, 1944. That was D-Day glider pilot Morris Bennett, and you can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. More than 406,000 Americans died while serving in World War II. They're among those fallen heroes we honor this Memorial Day weekend. Each one of them has a unique story, of course, and when we come back, we'll follow along on one man's quest to learn more about the courageous uncle he lost in World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll have one more Countdown to D-Day episode next time as we hear from men who jumped behind enemy lines 75 years ago. And as we come down the home stretch of today's episode, let's do what our nation sets aside a day for every year. As we mark Memorial Day weekend, let's honor the more than 1 million Americans who have given what President Lincoln famously called their last full measure of devotion for our country. Maybe there's somebody in your family who is counted in that number. For me, it's my great-great-uncle, a World War I pilot killed in France. But I want you to hear today from Ken Beaton, a retired educator who has, for years, chronicled the stories of veterans in and around Carson City, Nevada. But recently, Ken completed a more personal quest, as described in the book A Toddler's Picture in His Uncle's Helmet, capturing his journey of discovery as he sought to learn more about his uncle, Richard Daigle, who was killed while serving with the Devil's Brigade, the famed 1st Special Service Force, made up of American and Canadian commandos, who played such a crucial role in the liberation of Italy in World War II.
Ever since I was a little kid and could remember, and I'm probably talking about 4 years old, my mother and her two sisters and my grandmother don't ask me how many times they said this, Ken, they'd say, your uncle carried your picture in his helmet when he was killed in action on Monte La Difensa in Italy, December 3rd, 1943. That was, you might as well say that was tattooed on my arm. as far as how many times that I heard this. And I thought it was a picture of me at 6 months. You know how they, whether you're male or female, they put you in a white gown and they prop you up and they squeeze toys and they get you to giggle and laugh and then hopefully click that nice picture. But no, this was a picture taken December 20th, 1942 in Mobile, Alabama. And I'm wearing my dad's chief's Coast Guard hat. My dad was in the Coast Guard. I'm in front of the trunk on my dad's 37 Chrysler. And it was that day, it was my uncle's 21st birthday. And he got killed in action 17 days short of his 22nd birthday. And that made an impression on me. I can remember my grandfather being quiet at a family gathering, and this would be, I was 13 or 14 at the time, and one of my aunts or my mom or my grandmother would say to my grandfather, "Pop, what are you thinking about Richard?" And he was the person that came home on December 22nd. He was the first person home, and instead of the telegram delivery kid getting a signature, because no one was home, he just stuffed it under the door, and my grandfather found that telegram, and it destroyed him. So can you imagine what Christmas was like 3 days later? I wrote a piece for the Nevada Appeal. I titled it A Blue Christmas, after Elvis's song. It had to be the bluest Christmas that they ever faced. I was young, and I don't think I was at my grandparents' house when there were a couple of guys, and I just assumed that they were from the force, that came and explained how Richard got killed. He and I think his foxhole mate had taken out one German machine gun nest. It was probably the MG-42, which got the nickname Hitler's buzzsaw because it fired 25 rounds per second, 1,500 rounds per minute. They said how he got this one machine gun nest in the battle, and a second machine gun nest got him, and I'm quite sure his foxhole mate, because the two of them were buried beside one another. The Graves Registration Report information, which was 31 pages that I requested, listed the person buried on my uncle's left and his right, and Harry Diet was one of the people.
And you didn't know any of these names. Oh, you'd heard the story about how he was killed secondhand from when you were a kid. But when you started investigating and learning more, what was your goal? Because I'm pretty sure you weren't thinking, hey, I'm going to write a book about everything I find, because you don't know yet what you're going to find. What was your ambition or your goal or your motivation?
I was so amazed. I mean, here he was. He was almost 22 years old. I was the first niece or nephew on my mom's side of the family. He had seen me before he enlisted in the Army in early 42. You know, I guess there's something special about the first one, you know, your firstborn. And apparently it was that way with him. I wanted to learn more about him. It seems so strange. How could you love someone to want to carry their picture? I hadn't done anything. I was just the, you know, babies are just kind of a blob. They eat, you know, you need to change their diapers. Everything's done for them. I wanted to find out more about him, and I sent letters, I made phone calls in 2002 to different guys in the force that I got information about. There was really no one that could tell me the exact stories. I did learn that he enjoyed playing poker. He must have smoked because there was a lighter, and I believe there were cigarettes as far as personal effects. And I learned about his girlfriend. I discovered her from the name being engraved on a knife. She was a student nurse, and my aunt, the youngest in the family, had told me just this one thing. She didn't tell me any name. She couldn't remember the name, but she said Richard had a girlfriend when he was training at Fort Ethan Allen in Burlington, Vermont. When I started really doing some investigating, I Googled Burlington, Vermont hospitals, and there was only one, the Fanny Allen Hospital. I found out that they had a school of nursing, and the woman in archives says, yeah, Rachel Marguerite's parents lived in Bennington. So I Googled the Bennington town clerk, and he answered the phone himself. And he says, oh, you missed Rachel by about 5 months. She turned 90, and it was either the next day or the 2 days after her birthday that she passed away. And I'm there, oh no. And it was all my fault. And he said to me, I can give you the name of and the phone number of her adult daughter, Anna. When Anna came to the phone, I said, Anna, my name is Ken Beaton. I've been doing genealogy research about my uncle, Richard, and I've discovered that your mother was my uncle's girlfriend. And it was an oh moment on her part. And I told her a chapter of her mom's life that she didn't know about. Because what mom is going to sit down, hey, Anna, let me tell you about the guy I almost married, but he didn't come back from Italy. He got killed in action. No one's going to tell that story. And the only way her mom found out, because she wasn't a relative, she didn't get a telegram, was her Christmas card got returned to her. I have my mother's Christmas card that she sent to my uncle. She mailed it in the middle part of November of 1943, and it finally returned to her the beginning part of February. It had several return addresses on it. It had killed in KIA marked on that, and so it had to be a horrible way for Rachel to find out that this guy that she was romantically involved with, and if he came home, he would have married her. And so when I show people the book and I show people Rachel's picture, I say, you know, this is my almost aunt. She almost was my aunt. If my uncle had come home, he would have married her, but that didn't happen. So I got Rachel's picture, and I got Harry Dayette's picture. He was a T4. And I'm quite sure my uncle's foxhole mate, and that they got killed together, because I have proof, graves registration proof, that they were buried together. I got that picture from Harry's adult grandson, who's 55. Harry was older than my uncle by about 9 years, and he was a lumberjack, and that's what the force was looking for, outdoors type people. I still belong to the First Special Service Force Association, and I went to my first association annual meeting, and it was in Helena, Montana, where the force trained at Fort William Henry Harrison. I never was so welcomed. I didn't know anyone there. It is a great bunch of people, and that was in 2006, and I talked to a gentleman, Gianni Blasi. He has become an expert of the force, partly because it was the force that liberated his parents. He wasn't born yet. He was born after the war. He told me, and I just met him maybe 15 to 30 minutes earlier. He says, you email me before you come, and he says, we'll climb La Defensa together. And he told me something. He says, anything for the force.
And what was it like to climb up to the place where your uncle was killed, knowing that as he was there, your photo was in his helmet?
We identified the wall that they came up. It was somewhere between 100 to 200 feet where they had to use ropes and come up. And each guy had about 70 pounds on his back, because you had to carry in everything, your water, all your ammo. The guys that were mortar people, someone had to carry the tripod, someone had to carry the tube, and they all had rounds, mortar rounds, with them. And right about dawn, it was still dark, they hit the Germans. Our tracers were one color, and the German tracers were another color. And the way I heard it described, it kind of looked like 4th of July. Because there were tracers all over the place. They took that mountaintop in 2 hours' time. And the brass, the generals, thought it would take them a couple of months to take that. This is a Gold Star family story. It's not just the person that gets killed in action. The whole family carries that. He's been gone more than 75 years now. And my grandparents are gone, and in fact, all of his brothers and sisters are gone. His last sister died March 3rd. This is a Gold Star family story, and it's very important to remember the Gold Star families.
So your family's story is one of hundreds of thousands of stories like this. 406,000 Americans died in World War II. When I look at this cover of your book and I see that picture of you on your uncle's last birthday on Earth that he carried in his helmet and was with him when he was killed, did you ever feel like maybe he carried that picture because that's what he was fighting for? And that you're part of a generation of Americans that he knew he was risking his life for?
Well, it's part of the reason why you and I and everyone else in this country learned English. Otherwise, we'd be speaking German. Because Hitler had certain people designated who, when he conquered America, they were going to be the mayor for this community or that community or that. I couldn't believe that when I discovered that. And that's not that well known. Not that it's a top secret, but it just wasn't advertised. Maybe it's too scary. There were tough times, and this nation pulled together. And I hope that they get an appreciation of the sacrifice that. And this was just one person. And the Army had 7 million guys in the Army. Now, they all weren't carrying a rifle, because for every person you have in the front, you have about 10 support personnel, and every role is important. We owe so much to these people. That's partly why the reason why I write. I've interviewed a number of different vets, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War vets, and put their stories in a commentary in the Nevada Appeal, and giving those vets recognition.
Like you said, you've been interviewing veterans for so long and writing their stories, and it's clear that you've always had this appreciation for what they did and the value assigned to it. But going down this journey and learning more about your uncle and putting this book together, did you come to even deeper or more expansive understanding of what we mean when we talk about the price of freedom?
Yes, I did, because that first day in taking La Defensa, there were 39 of the boys killed in action, including my uncle's company commander, who was a captain, and their battalion commander, who I met his son, and their battalion commander died without knowing that his son was born, because the Canadians hadn't received their mail. All of their names are listed in what date and how many were killed in action and how many died of wounds. I know people have heard it before, but freedom is not free, and fly your flag on Memorial Day.
And when you fly your flag on Memorial Day, think about those courageous Americans it honors. People like Ken's uncle, Richard Daigle. That book, A Toddler's Picture in His Uncle's Helmet, is linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. As Ken said, it's the story of one Gold Star family. And perhaps you know a Gold Star family. Say an extra prayer for them this Memorial Day weekend. And don't let this be the only weekend of the year that you live in a way that assigns a greater value to that liberty that so many have given their lives for. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll remember on Memorial Day and every day that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.